Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to the other podcast every Saturday night at 7 p.m. We are here on a new format. We are on podbeam.com, as you know, if you're listening to us. Trust you will download the app and do everything necessary to hear us. And I'm your host, Robert Stacy McCain.
I'm not. I'm the other guy on the other podcast. I'm John Hogue. And I'm busily trying to get things working. We've got all sorts of issues that have picked up because I'm still learning how to run this thing. So I'm getting ready to send another invite out. Stacy, why don't you get on the phone for a few seconds and get the person I just invited to call.
Okay, I will do that. You're going to fill the time with
our opening.
Okay.
I'm going to talk about one of the reasons why I like the NHL. We do a lot of stuff around the fall about the football, and I'm somewhat less than pleased about how things have been going with football, particularly at the start of the games. I just have an issue with some of the lack of patriotism, but one of the reasons why I really like what's going on with the NHL is because at least at the beginning of the games, they'll stand for this music. Of the second stanza.
Yeah, the final words of the Star Spangled Banner are play ball. Play hockey. I don't know. I've never been a big hockey fan, but it was nice to see them standing for the national anthem.
Well, yes, of course they were standing for O Canada as well.
Okay.
And of course, I sing O Canada.
Yeah, I'm not very much for O Canada.
Oh, I use it as an excuse to practice my French. I sing along in French.
Yeah, it's one of the worst national anthems ever.
Actually, it is kind of a wimpy national anthem.
Yes.
Then again, never mind.
Oh, Canada, our home and native land. I mean, how much it's actually redundant.
Well, actually, it's the words are a little more powerful in French. But anyway, I'm used to, I have a couple. We were talking about our connections to the national anthem before we got started. And I have two from my youth. One is working as a radio announcer. The final strains of the national anthem are followed by reaching over and pulling the plate stop switch to turn off the transmitter at midnight. But when I took ROTC, they told me if I played in the band, I didn't have to clean an M1 every week. So I played it hundreds of times as a mellophone or tuba player in our Army ROTC band, and conducted it hundreds of times as the drum major or the bandmaster. So that particular arrangement I know by heart.
Yeah, I played trombone in the high school marching band, and the national anthem, the arrangement that we had a great pattern of running eighth notes, and that last little part of it that always stand out in my mind. And I remember, you marched onto the field, and then you stood at attention while all the announcements and everything were made, and you stood there and stood there and stood there. And then you played the national anthem, and then everybody had to, you went to parade rest and bowed your head while they played, while they gave the invocation.
Yep.
But it was at my high school, Douglas County High School in Georgia, somebody finally filed a lawsuit that resulted in making it illegal to have an invocation before a football game. It was the kid's name was Schaefer. I remember that. That was just, but atheists.
Yeah. Well, Diana, you're with us as usual. What are your connections? To the Star Spangled Banner.
I sang it once. in high school. Along with three other people, we did it as a trio, and it was in three-part harmony. Oh, and I was so nervous, I think I choked on the high note.
I was listening to your adult voice, I would have guessed that you were a mezzo or an alto, but...
That is the fault of many, many years of cigarettes and whiskey.
Cigarettes and whiskey. Well, anyways...
in moderation, whiskey is good for you, so...
This is true, but cigarettes are not good for you in any kind of quantity. So
wait a minute, Diana, I'm still alive and you're still alive. I'm just pointing that out.
On the other hand, I grew up in a family of smokers.
Mm-hmm.
Between my father and my mother, they'd smoke a carton a week, two of themselves. I can remember being about 7 or 8 years old and looking at my father and saying, he's taking a rolled up paper tube of crushed dead leaves, setting fire to one end and sucking on the other. Why? And it just never appealed to me after that. I could understand why my Uncle Phil smoked a pipe, but I never got cigarettes.
To this day, I miss cigarettes, but I like breathing.
Well, the thing is, I will have to say this, is that I cannot understand how anyone can be a writer and not smoke cigarettes. It's just something that the two things just seem to go together.
Case, I can't understand how someone can be a writer and not consume mass quantities of coffee. So there it is.
Well, I do. Oh, yeah. But yes. But
we're all going to die of something. And one of the best theses you had this week was an obituary.
Mm-hmm. Our good friend Herman Cain died this week at... age 74, complications from COVID-19. I first met Herman Cain in 2007 when I was working for the Washington Times and flew down to Atlanta and interviewed him at the studios of WSB Radio in Atlanta what they call white columns there on, I want to say it's west, right off of West Peachtree Street. Mm-hmm. But
yep.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Okay. That I'm glad my memory hasn't failed. But
I mean, that's one of the radio stations that if you're in the radio, have been in the radio business in Nashville. I mean, knowing about WSB is like knowing about WSM.
Yeah. Yeah. It was one of the WSB stood for Welcome South, Brother. But Herman Cain had just returned to doing talk radio in 2007 after surviving a serious battle with colon cancer. He had stage 4 colon cancer. And he had recovered from that and was and I've got a photo on my blog. If you'll go to my blog, theothermccain.com. You will see a picture of a smiling Herman Cain. That photo was taken by my older brother, Kirby, who's quite the photographer. And the first time I met Mr. Cain and you know, walk out, shook his hand, and I said, hey, don't Google me. Because, you know, I had been smeared as a white supremacist, long story. But anyways, I said, don't Google me. And he smiled and said, I already did. And I just kind of laughed. And we got along famously. And then, actually, I had first heard of Herman Cain because of my older brother, Kirby, who called me up in 2004 to said, hey, this Herman Cain guy is the real deal. He was running in the Senate primary down there in Georgia, and he came in behind Johnny Isaacson. But he really made an impression and was a very popular talk radio host. Back in the 90s, he had testified against Hillary Care. Right. As the head of the National Restaurant Association, and his testimony about what it would cost and the damage that Hillary Care would have done to the small business owners and restaurant owners. It was really decisive in that. But anyways, so when 2012 rolled around, and I mean immediately after is on election night 2010, I got a call from a friend of mine named Steve, we had covered Tea Party campaigns together, and Steve said he had started a draft Herman Cain page, and he said, so how about, are you in? I said, well, I'm going to check and see what Palin's going to do. And so the next day I called Palin's people, and then I called Ellen Carmichael, who was working for Herman, and I said, are y'all in or out? Because I was getting mixed signals from Palin. And Ellen was like, well, I can't say officially, but... And I could say, yeah, that's a green light. That's a green light, isn't it? So I was all in during 2011. I was all in for Herman Cain. When I first started out, he was the longest of long shots. And all my friends in the press corps were like, ah, you're crazy. All my blogger friends, that Herman Cain. But then in July, and I remember this very clearly, the Texas governor.
Perry.
Yeah. Rick Perry melted down in a debate in Tampa.
Oops.
And that's when Herman took off, because, it was up. It had been up and down and up and down the polls. And Herman took off and was at the top. By the time we got to Las Vegas in October, all my friends in the press corps were going, man, you're a genius, because Herman was on top. And when you start off with a long shot candidate like that, right, you're right next to him. Like, I was out in Iowa with him in August of 2011. I was just right there next to him. The first time we went to see him, my son Jeff and I went with him, and we were in Maryland over here near, I think it was Silver Spring at a mansion. you know, and the big thing. And we went and you could just, you know, walk up and talk to him. And you remember Mark, the smoking guy, right? Who was became famous during that campaign, his campaign manager. I was hanging out with all these guys. But then, of course, by the time he became the top candidate, the Secret Service is there, the security and everything like that. And you couldn't get near him. And he just would, like, as they were rushing him from one place to another, he would just wave at you, you know. But anyways.
But, you know.
He died.
He died. And it didn't take
10 5 seconds.
Well, I was going to say from the
almost time, immediately the ghouls began dancing on his grave.
I within 5 minutes of the time I knew he was dead, I was seeing tweets that bad mouthing him.
Yeah, it was the most shameful. The left is so shameful, and but they were convinced, by the way, that Mr. Kane contracted the COVID virus at that Tulsa rally, but people close to him said that that wasn't it. So I don't know, but the thing is that obviously he's in a high risk category, as are you.
Yeah.
As is my brother. I guess I'm not necessarily low risk.
But you're in the be careful category. But I mean, here's the thing. That kind of reaction,
right,
just to me shows the desperation on the left about being able to sell their thing. And I did a post where I basically spun off of something that Sarah Hoyt had posted, but I titled the post "Past Their Sell-By Date." She had a really thoughtful piece over at PJ Media explaining why she expects the current play acting at Revolution that's going on the left will fail. And she, remember, she's not a native born citizen. She was raised in Portugal at the time when there was literally a kind of slow motion revolution going on between the National Socialists and the International Socialist parties, but basically between the fascists and the communists.
I guess I don't have to tell you which side of that I was on. It was Salazar.
Yeah.
Is that who I'm thinking of? Was the dictator of
And he was a national socialist, a phalangist, basically.
Yeah, the good kind.
But anyway, she made the point.
Not really.
Okay, look, if you're gonna have a dictator, don't have a commie dictator. Excuse me.
Well, anyway, basically.
Very true.
Her point is that the left has this distorted view of reality because of a Marxist philosophical presuppositions that they have, and they can't understand why their efforts to bring about utopia keep failing. And that, so basically they're having a tantrum because reality isn't fair. They expect the 99% will rise up in solidarity with them to overthrow the 1% of capitalist oppressors. But what they don't understand is that the left has won a slow revolutionary march through the institutions over the past 50 years. And it's the left who make up most of the 1% now.
Well, I mean, all the big corporations that the liberals hate, you know, that the radicals, these young millennial punks, the big corporations like Amazon, stuff like that, they're all run by these wokistas.
Well, but the thing is that, but given the kind of mindset, I mean, if you think about when Marxism comes together and what's going on in society and where that works in terms of the Industrial Revolution and the urbanization of society, communism and socialism are just like an insane opportunity about how to deal with the change in society caused by mass production and mass movements of people. Basically, in the 21st century, that whole worldview is like fish out of water. And every move that the left is making, basically, they're firing these torpedoes that circle back and are headed at them, right? In effect, what we're seeing, I think, with what's going on in places like Portland is You have a bunch of proles who thought they were guaranteed a spot in the outer party based on going to college, and they really were hoping that they might even have a shot at being into getting into the inner party based on merit, and they're raging because they've got a fill in the blank studies degree that doesn't qualify them for anything other than struggling to service the debt on their degree and working for barista's wages. And basically you have one part of the left revolting against the other. Now that's happened before. During the middle years of the last century, we kind of saw a slugfest between international socialism and national socialism in Europe. And well, Sarah Hoyt was basically supposed argues that what we're seeing isn't the birth pains of a new revolution, it's the death rattle of an old one. And I sure hope she's right. But meanwhile, we have the left at least running the House of Representatives. You were suggesting that maybe their campaign slogan going into the fall should be "Reclaiming My Time."
Yes. Yes. This week, they had a House Judiciary Committee. Now, folks, there's two judiciary committees. We most of the time we pay attention to the Senate Judiciary Committee, which is where Supreme Court justices are approved. But this was the House Judiciary Committee, and because Democrats are the majority in the House, they get to set the rules under Judiciary Chairman Jerry Nadler, who is the biggest Jerry Nadler.
The biggest actually kind of works as a
he is something else. He's a weeble is what he is. You remember weebles wobble, but they don't fall down. Anyways,
they don't fall down.
Right. Anyways, but the rotund Jerry Nadler is the chairman there. And so I was working on a Spectator column, and which I did not actually get finished this week. And I had my TV turned on. And the office TV sits behind the right, my right ear. So it's not in view as I'm looking at the computer. It's sort of, so I have to turn around and look at it. And I'm kind of listening to it out of one ear, and over and over and over again, it was "Reclaiming my time, Mr. Chairman. I'm reclaiming my time." And it was Kabuki theater, as I called it. What had happened was that they had set up this rule to where each member of the committee got 5 minutes of time. Now, this was the rule agreed to. And so what you would start out, you would get a 3-minute lecture. Right. From the House Democrat would begin with this reading off this sort of lecture that would end with a question to the man. Isn't this true? Or do you deny this? And they're accusing him of everything from treason to complicity in murder. And what they were trying to do was to stage a gotcha moment for YouTube or for MSNBC or whatever. And so
they're desperate to have something to run as a campaign ad.
Right. And so they're doing this, and Barb was completely unflappable, but he just had to sit there and take that abuse.
Oh, there was this wonderful exchange for this one Congress critter asked him to basically commit to not releasing the Durham report before the election, and his complete answer was no.
He is the honey badger. Honey badger don't care. And at one point, a California Democrat interrupted his, you know, he was trying, what would happen was every time he would try to answer their questions, they would come back with reclaiming my time. So anyway, so he gets interrupted by a Democrat named Lou Correa. And he says, this is a hearing. I thought I was the one who was supposed to be heard. You've got the attorney general here, you know, and another great moment was when Jamie Raskin, who, by the way, is a commie. Okay, Jamie Raskin is a red diaper communist. Okay, his father was even, it was, his father was, well, if the Smith Act had been in place, okay, Jamie Raskin's father would have gone to Leavenworth. But anyways, he asked Barr, are you aware that the director of the church, that the Episcopal Bishop of Washington, the Bishop of the Episcopal Church nationally, along with the Catholic Bishop of the Archdiocese of Washington, all denounced this police assault on the civil rights and civil liberties of the people, talking about when they cleared Lafayette Park.
Did they do that before or after the fire was put out?
Yes, yeah. And it was, yes. And anyways, and Jim Jordan just went off on Nadler and said, for months you have tried to get the attorney general to come testify. He's here. Why don't you let him speak? Why don't you let him answer the questions? And so there was some back and forth. Ace of Spades called it a Stalin-esque show trial. But to be fair, it didn't end with Barr being executed in the basement of the Lubyanka. So, you know, that's all that could be said for it. But it was not a hearing. It was a campaign event. And I can't imagine any fair-minded person watching this and being persuaded to vote Democrat.
The problem is, you know, so many of these people, I mean, you have a real rift between the old-time quasi-moderate Democratic Party of the sort represented by their current candidate, Joe Biden, before he went senile. And Nancy Pelosi is a part of that party as well, and Chuck Schumer's a part of that party. You have a rift between that and basically an incredibly hyper left-wing AOC, Bernie party. And what the people, what these septuagenarians that think they're in charge of the Democratic Party don't understand is when the revolution comes, they're going to be among the first up against the wall.
Well, they already have been. For example, Joe Crowley got beat in a Democratic primary. Joe Crowley was a down-the-line progressive, got beat in a Democratic primary by AOC. And this year, they had another guy, and I'm trying to remember his name, in New York also. No, it was New Jersey, the Democrat. And I'll tell you, Democrat primary. Okay, let me see if I can't get that. I'm going to have to Google this guy's name.
But I mean, look, you have there a strategy that's happening in densely populated blue, already deep blue areas.
Right.
That have a huge number of immigrants, both legal and illegal, voting there. And it's, you know, it's a perfect example of, well, if we can't get Americans to vote for us, we'll import voters who will.
I'm sorry, it's Elliot Engel. And I'm going to tell you who it was. Elliot Engel. Oh, and this was in a this was in New York. Jamal Bowman defeated Elliot Engel And I'm going to tell you what district this was. But he was a 16-term incumbent, Elliot Engel. And I'm trying to find out what district that was in New York. But anyway, so now, and as I said of this, is that, you know, it's not their party anymore. Right? They got to realize that, you know, Joe Biden, Nancy Pelosi, Chuck Schumer, you know, it's not their party. They have invited, you know, these, as you say, you know, to import voters, you know, and they're being replaced, you know.
Right.
They're going to be the last of their kind.
Yeah. And well, yes and no. I mean, there's still a substantial number of people who I'll just say are Gen Xers and maybe even some Gen Ys and maybe even some millennials who, you know, aren't quite, they're not quite as far over the top as the AOCs and Bernies. And there's still a significant, huge chunk of those folks inside the Democratic Party. The Democrats are going to need to figure out which party they are. Okay.
Yeah.
And maybe they have to split into two parties. Either, you know, the Whigs and the Republicans fell apart. And we don't have a lot of Whigs anymore.
Yeah. Well, I mean, this, you know, the question of which of the two major parties is going to collapse into obsolescence is.
Both of the parties are quite old by any standards. You know, the Republicans reasonably can trace themselves back to the 1858 congressional elections, the Democrats can trace themselves mm-hmm. back legitimately to the 1828 presidential election with Jackson.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, the Democratic Republican Party of Jefferson, Madison, and you know that crowd, you know that. Basically, is a different party from
no. What happened? And if I can just trace the history of the party development is that Jefferson, in alliance with Aaron Burr, formed what was the Democrat-Republican Party.
The Democratic-Republican Party.
Right, right. And this was the first partisan machine. And this was during the presidency
of
John Adams, the elder. And this was why John Adams was a one-term president.
Right. Okay. It's also why his son was a one time.
Right. Right. And so that led to what became known as the Virginia dynasty, where Jefferson, Madison, and James Monroe, okay, each two-term presidents from Virginia, Democrat, Republican, each ran, you know, held 8 years. So for 24 years, these three Virginians held the presidency. But then what had been left of the old Federalist Party that had been destroyed, because this was the age of patronage.
Convention.
Okay. If you wanted to be a postmaster, a judge, any kind of federal position, during this era, you could not oppose this machine that Jefferson had built. And so this Federalist remnant, the remnants of the old Federalist Party, rallied behind John Quincy Adams and got him elected. Mm-hmm. And that was
just barely.
Yeah, and the 1824 election was, as it was called at the time, the corrupt bargain that got Adams got in there. And then 4 years later, here comes Jackson roaring back with this frontier populism.
And that was a very different party from the Virginia Dynasty Party, and really a separate party And if you look at the way things trace from there, that's where you get the Democratic Party that leads us to the Civil War and leads us through the South and Reconstruction, and then leads us to FDR. Yeah. Okay. And
Woodrow Wilson. You left out Woodrow Wilson, but I'm going to make the point. And one of the things I wrote the night of the 2012 election, I wrote a column that the headline of it was widely cited with mirth by the left. It was called "Doomed Beyond All Hope of Redemption." Okay. My idea is that I had expected Obama to be a one-term president, and everything was lined up after the big Tea Party sweep in 2010. Everything was lined up for the Republicans. All they had to do was to stay on that populist message, and we got Mitt Romney.
Well, that's because the Republican Party from 1988 to 2012 basically was their nominee based on your resume.
Well, the point being that when that was over, you know, is that I never blamed or fomented hatred against Obama. I always viewed the Obama presidency as proof of the failure of the Republican Party. Any party that would nominate John McCain as president is simply incompetent. John McCain, Americans would never vote for that fool. And he was a bad person. Okay, I will say this. John McCain was a bad person. And you can say, oh, well, what about you're questioning his patriotism. He was not someone that Americans would elect president ever.
Look, patriotism is something that can be separated from whether or not somebody is either evil or incompetent. Either which would qualify for someone to be a bad politician. I mean, if all you're dealing with is patriotism, I mean, hell, Al Capone was patriotic. He was also a good organizer and entrepreneur, but I wouldn't have wanted him for president. You know, but speaking of entrepreneurship, one of the things that you can find if you go to The Other McCain, which is a very interesting blog, is a yellow button.
Yes, let me tell you about the yellow button, folks. If you will go to theothermccain.com, theothermccain.com. Yeah, in the middle of the center column, you will see a yellow button with the word donate on it. And if you will click on that button, it will take you to my PayPal account where you can contribute dollars, yen, what other currency? Shekels? I take shekels.
Shekels?
PayPal will even take one.
Rubles?
Take one. I got euros. Somebody actually hit my tip jar for 10 euros.
I have been hit with euros. Whoa. I've been hit with euros, Canadian dollars, Aussie dollars, pounds. I mean, and I cheerfully smile and say,
yes. Anyway, so, but it helps support the blog and my various bad habits, and also to support the podcast. But meanwhile, over at my good friend John Hogue's blog, Hogwash.com.
In fact, I don't have a yellow button. I have a tip jar icon over in the sidebar on the right. And click on that. And I am very thankful and appreciative for donations to support the blog. I also have, if you scroll down a little bit further, there's a picture of a silly hat. If you click on that, you'll be taken to the Hogwash store. And there's all sorts of interesting things that you can buy. And I get a cut of the action when Cafe Press ships them to you. So please do that if you would like to buy trinkets. And by the way, there's one thing I should tell you about bloggers in general. A lot of us participate in what's called the Amazon Associates Program. And in fact, you'll see various links that to Amazon. And if you buy on those links and they're an approved link, the blogger you're buying through will receive a commission. You can find that at Hogwash. You can find that at The Other McCain. You can find it at lots of wonderful blogs around the interwebs. So if you want to support a blogger, there's a way to do that as well. Meanwhile, though, we would like to have Diana remind you of the five most important words in the English language.
The five most important words in the English language are hit the freaking tip jar and do it often.
Yes.
The last is my addition.
Well, you can pretend that you're a Chicago voter.
Oh, no. Yes, folks.
Tip early and often.
Thank you for the shameless commerce moment.
Yes.
And we now return to the news.
Well, or actually, I don't know how much of the news.
You're too peaceful.
You listen to what some of these politicians are saying about riots and public safety and that sort of stuff. Mm-hmm. And I had a post basically called that said, they're only kidding. There are a few crazies out there some of the city councils who really think that it's a smart idea to defund their police departments. But none of the serious...
Seattle wants to totally abolish theirs.
Yeah.
In fact, they actually passed that. I think they're in. Go on. Sorry.
Yeah. Well, no. I mean, yeah, sorry. Yeah. Well, but okay. But no one would accuse the Seattle City Council of being serious politicians.
It's a clown show, folks.
But the serious politicians.
I'm reminded of the ambassador's conversation during the negotiations at Riga. The German ambassador turns to the Viennese and he says, "The situation is serious, but it's not hopeless." And the Viennese ambassador looks at him and says, very, very gently, "No, my friend. The situation is hopeless, but it's not serious."
Yeah, well, you know, there are the serious people out there in a lot of these city councils, though, realize that the police are not going to be completely defunded in the real world. Look, it's a political. Someone has to enforce the inner party's political will, and that requires violence when necessary, or at least the threat of violence at sometimes. So you're going to call the city. You can call the city employees that do that cops or whatever you want to, but the function of guarding the inner party and enforcing its will always be one of the basic functions of local government, state government, national government. Now, granted, funding could be reduced for some employees who maintain order among the paroles for a while, but as long as there's no disturbance in the inner party's calm or challenge to its control, that's a tactical detail that can be administered by the outer party bureaucracy. After all, if there's no one around to enforce the law, people might go to the grocery store without wearing a mask or something like that, or even worse.
I have a different thought on that.
Oh,
I have a different thought on that. I've been thinking that watching a bunch of blue cities devolve into heavily armed and very suspicious enclaves is going to end real well.
Well, yeah, you're already starting to see some of the wheels come off of this and some of reality impinging on things. Now, I was... you left some cognitive distance here because I was assured that the summer protests are all peaceful, but apparently the Democrats are having trouble cobbling together a sufficient police presence to provide security for their convention in Milwaukee. I mean, what are they worried about? It's not like this is 1968 or something.
It's a lot worse. I think SDS from 1968 was sane compared to some of these people.
Okay.
And that's saying something.
Well, I mean, yeah, but you have this guy who's supposedly got a genius level IQ. Apparently, he's like an adjunct faculty at some place like MIT, and he goes to burn down a courthouse with his shirt off.
Yes.
And he has a distinctive tattoo. I mean,
yes, a man named Edward Thomas Schinzing, 32. is now facing federal arson charges, accused of setting and spreading fire May 29th inside the Justice Center in Portland at the start of 2 months of protest. And how did the feds apprehend this criminal genius? Well, they were helped by the fact that A, Schinzing was shirtless during the mostly peaceful protest, and B, he has his rather distinctive surname tattooed on his back.
I mean, occasionally you hear one of these dumb crook stories where the guy is robbing the bank and drops his wallet with his driver's license in it. But I mean, this is like, that's an accident. This is like, hello, testing.
Yeah.
Did you not think that anyone would have a camera?
Meanwhile, in Aurora, Colorado, Samuel Young, 23, has been charged with two counts of attempted murder and other charges. In Aurora, Colorado, they were having a quote-unquote peaceful protest obstructing an interstate highway, I-225, I believe it is. Let's see what that's
It'll
called.
Be 225.
225, yeah, 225, 255, whatever.
25,
yeah.
I-25 is the main north-south interstate on the Front Range.
Okay, so this is the bypass. So they're on 225, and they blocked both lanes, both directions near East 6th Avenue in Aurora, when a Jeep driven by 27-year-old Kyle Faucuson comes up and decides he's going to just drive through. So everybody scatters out of the way. Nobody was hit. However, Mr. Young pulled out what a witness called an old-school Wild West gun, a revolver, and fired toward the Jeep and actually struck two of his protest comrades. Didn't hit the Jeep that we know of,
but
he did wound two of his fellow protesters. So he's now facing attempted murder charges, and I hope that they'll be that he can – he can show his support for Black Lives Matter while he's in the state penitentiary.
Yeah, well,
if you know what I mean, and I think you do.
Yes, well, it'll get flea bargained down to reckless endangerment.
Yeah,
Isn't as bad a crime.
Well, yeah,
which probably isn't as bad a crime in Colorado as it is in Maryland. One of my fishing buddies, a trooper, and he got called out to this house in the country that where rounds were impacting into the house. He went over to where they were coming from. A couple of old boys got liquored up and were doing target practice and, you know, not paying attention to what was behind the backstop. So it turns out, he arrested them and brought them in. And the state's attorney charged them with some very serious crime. And Judge Smith, who was the judge at the time, was noted as our hanging judge. He went through the trial, and he was it was a bench trial. And they said, it's 11:30. Let's break for lunch, and I'll be back with the verdict after lunch. And apparently, he'd gone to the had lunch in the law library in the courthouse because he came back and said, I'm not going to find you guys guilty of whatever it was they've been charged with. I'm going to find you guilty of the lesser included offense of reckless endangerment, but I'm going to give you the maximum sentence under Maryland law. It's a bit misdemeanor, by the way, and you'll be able to vote while you're in prison, but you're going to be in prison for 20 years.
Whew! For a misdemeanor? How does that work?
Maryland is a common law state, and a lot of our crimes are misdemeanors because back under common law, the distinction between a misdemeanor and a felony was the death penalty. And so we have a lot of crimes that because they aren't death penalty crimes, by the way, we don't have a death penalty anymore anyway, but because they never were death penalty crimes are still misdemeanors.
Yes, well.
And some of them you can get 20, some of them you can get 20 years for.
Speaking of crime, from Louisiana, we have the tale of two young criminal masterminds. They are accused, what happened was, is that in Wichita, how do you pronounce that? Wichita Parish?
Yeah.
Louisiana. The Louisiana State Patrol stopped a speeding car on Louisiana Highway 17 in Franklin Parish. The driver was identified as Michael Dwayne Mitchell Jr., 18. During the stop, police say they noticed the smell of marijuana. Mitchell admitted to smoking marijuana, and a search of the car was conducted. And that's when the police found the body of the man in the trunk. The victim was identified as Michael Robinson Jr., 23, of Monroe. Mitchell then confessed to taking part in an armed robbery, which resulted in the victim's death. By the way, he was speeding in the victim's car. Mitchell said that he and his accomplice, Cameron Powell, 19, loaded the body into the victim's vehicle and planned to leave the victim and the vehicle at a site in the Winnsboro area. Mitchell was stopped before he could get there. Folks, I don't want to help criminals get away with their felonies, but I'm just telling you something. If you've got a body in the trunk, you might want to do the speed limit. I'm just throwing that out there.
Yeah, well, on the other hand, stuff in the trunk can cause all sorts of interesting problems for criminals. For example, if you leave the timers in the trunk while you're dressed in a fake DOD police officer uniform and going to a print shop to get forged Department of Defense driver's licenses, you really should have cleaned the trunk out.
We know who he's talking about here. The diminutive the pro se pipsqueak, as I've called him, Brett Kimberlin.
Yeah, I mean that's how the Speedway bomber got busted.
Yes, and we know all about the Speedway bomber. If you're new regular listeners, you know, but here we are on Podbeam.
Yes, we are, and we have an interesting thing here. You know, we're doing news coverage, but. I do this as an amateur, really. I haven't been a professional news guy since the early 70s. Stacy, on the other hand, is strictly professional. Yeah, I know the cue. We don't have a hard ending, Stacy. So I'm
all right, okay.
He keeps wanting me.
A hard ending.
We can run to 180 minutes if we have to.
Oh, okay.
But so if we go a minute or six over, anyway. Besides, I've got enough time left that I didn't time to roll it yet. You seem to have learned that you're supposed to keep your mouth shut about certain things. Whereas Brian Stetler over at CNN was running his mouth about the Sandman settlement and got caught doing it.
This is the Sandman. Yeah. This is the Covington Catholic Red Hat case.
Yes, and basically, the the lawyer for Nicholas Sandman has basically said, oh, that breaches the confidentiality agreement. And first of all, and secondly, he's a liar, and we don't know how to deal with it. So apparently, there's been some speculation about, what might happen in terms of employment there. But I'll just give you my pro tip left over from over almost 50 years ago. But I learned it actually probably in Sunday school in the 50s. For everything, there's a season and a time for every purpose under heaven, a time to keep silence and a time to speak. Meanwhile, speaking of silence, in another legal case, there were a whole bunch of documents sealed. And that case a lawsuit against Ghislaine Maxwell. Apparently, Maxwell had made some remarks about one of the people who was accusing her.
Yes, and this is Ghislaine Maxwell, who was the protege or what, hench person for Jeffrey Epstein.
If you believe the, what's been said about her by the plaintiff in this lawsuit, the procurer for Epstein. But regardless,
procuress. There's a really good word for that. Procuress. Yes.
Madam. But anyway, she Maxwell then made some remarks about the person who had been interviewed in the British press, a young woman from Florida. And this woman has sued Maxwell for defaming her. And the case is in the Southern District of New York. It got to what's called summary judgment, which is where both sides say, look, here's the evidence. And this it's based on the uncontested evidence. One side should win as a matter of law. And the judge looked at it and said, no, there's enough contested stuff here that a jury needs to decide which side is correct. And so it was denied, but it was also sealed. And some news organizations sought to have it unsealed. And a lot of people whose names were mentioned in the evidence sought to keep it sealed. And on Friday, last year, the Court of Appeals ruled that it would be unsealed after it had been redacted. And Friday, about 2,000 pages of evidence and court papers were released with some redactions on things like the names of children. There are some people whose reputations may suffer as a result of this, and some organizations as well. One of them's the FBI, and I have a post up as of this afternoon that actually shows some of the things that in the evidence that relate to the FBI. And given their performance recently, hello testing, this might raise a few more eyebrows. So that's what's out there. But, not only are evil people dangerous, crazy people are dangerous.
Yes. And folks, a couple of weeks ago, I told you the story of a certain Daniel Hernandez. Daniel Hernandez was shot to death in Los Angeles after refusing to comply with the police order's repeated command, drop the knife. Now, you might think people would have learned this lesson by now, okay? If the cop has a gun and you've got a knife and the cop says, drop the knife, what do? You drop the knife. But stupidity is pandemic. An intoxicated knife-wielding man was shot as he charged at a Phoenix police officer while threatening to slice her throat. The video footage released Thursday by Phoenix police shows suspect John David Brousseau, 55, repeatedly threatening to stab a female officer when she encountered him on June 14th in a parking lot of a supermarket. Officers responded to the scene after someone called 911 to report that a, quote, drunk man armed with a knife, end quote, was threatening customers inside the store. Drop the knife, the officer tells Brousseau. Put it on the ground. And he says, no, I'm going to F you up. Anyways, and so she's backing up and he says, shut your effing mouth. Shoot me. I'll kill you, you stupid little. I'll effing slice your effing throat. No, sir, you will not. And so she plugged him and shot him only once. However, there will be no protest marches decrying excessive force by the Phoenix police because, you see, John David Brousseau was white.
Yeah, well, on the other hand, at least I can say that I've had enough sense that the only time I brought a knife to a gunfight is a bayonet.
Yes, well, anyways, if you're stupid enough to bring a knife to a gunfight, you deserve whatever happens to you.
Yeah.
But crazy people are dangerous, and hat tip on that to Bo Snerdly, Rush Limbaugh's side man. Diana, thank you for joining us on our first Podbean version of The Other McCain.
And we look forward
You're welcome.
We'll look forward to more of these. And by the way, we may also have additional non-live podcasts as well. So this is going to develop.
7 p.m. Saturday.
We will be back next week. Thanks for tuning in for the stars.
Breeze.